Blog Talk Radio.
Radio Free Palmer, 89.5 KVRF, presents Mushing Radio, hosted by Robert Forto. Mushing Radio is about dog-powered sports, living in the Great White North, and mushing. Visit our website at mushingradio.com. Here is your host, Robert Forto.
Hello and welcome, everybody. This is Robert Forto, hosting from KVRF 89.5 FM in Palmer, Alaska. And this is day four of our Iditarod coverage for the 2013 race. And on the line, we have calling in from sunny California, our co-host. His name is Alex Stein. He is the writer and director of Mush the Movie. It just premiered up here in Alaska on PBS this past weekend. Hope you guys got a chance to watch it. If not, it will probably re-air. If not, maybe we'll find out if we can get you a copy to send us a message on our Facebook page at Dog Works Radio. Without further ado, Alex Stein. Alex, how's it going?
It's going great, Robert. It's the world is a little bit turned upside down because it's actually cold down here and it's starting to rain. And yet up there in Alaska, it's relatively warm.
You know, I think we're in the middle of breakup already here in early March. Got quite a few puddles out on the streets, and the mushers are complaining about the warm weather. What do you have to report about that?
Yeah, it has been unseasonably warm. And usually, even if it's in the 20s at the start of the race, Willow, usually once we get to the Alaska range, it cools off quite a bit. This year, we're seeing temperatures hovering around or even above freezing for the early part of the race, and it looks like it's not going to get a whole lot cooler, at least not for a while. Now, of course, predicting weather is an inexact science, especially in Alaska, where things can change pretty quickly. But one of the things that's really characterized the race so far is that we've had very, very warm weather, which means that it's a lot harder for the dogs to run during the day, and most of the mushers, whenever possible, are doing runs at night.
You know, that is exactly right. And for some, Martin Boosser included, they're playing that into their strategy. I know that several mushers had commented to checkers and the media at the checkpoints that they wanted to get through some of the most difficult parts of the trail during the daylight, even though if it may have been a little warmer. They wanted to do that in the daylight so they would be a little safer than they would normally do and do those runs at night.
Right, absolutely. And, you know, it's important for people who may not be as familiar with dog mushing to keep in mind that these are serious work animals who are trained to run long distances. So this is not your typical inside lap dog. These are highly skilled athletes, and as a result, the mushers have to be very careful about making sure that they're properly hydrated. 30 or 35 degrees might seem cool to a lot of people. I know it seems cool to people in Southern California, but for these dogs, they're really trained to run at much colder temperatures, and they're more comfortable when it's about, I think, 10 above to anywhere down to like 20 or 30 degrees below.
Right, and I know I mentioned this on a previous broadcast. Optimum temperature, at least for my teams over the years, has seemed to be about that 10 degree above and 10 degree below mark. That's where I'm finding it to be the most comfortable for the dogs. But, you know, there was one musher in particular that dealt with dehydration just yesterday, the Mushin Mortician. His name is Scott Jansen. He ended up scratching in Rainy Pass last night about 8:30, shortly after our broadcast. He had left Rainy Pass, and then as he was on the trail, his dogs just started falling down from dehydration, and he had quite a scare pretty much in the same area last year. What do you have to report on Scott, Alex?
Yeah, he was a couple miles outside of the checkpoint, and I believe it was two of his leaders just kind of fell over, and he had put them in the sled, and the rest of his dogs, I think, were a little bit spooked by what had happened, and he decided because he didn't want to have a repeat of what happened last year, which, as people might recall, he had a dog that that lost consciousness, and he had to give it mouth-to-snout resuscitation, and was able to revive the dog, and the dog was fine. But he, out of an abundance of caution and wanting to make sure that he took care of the dogs above everything else, he returned back the couple miles to Rainy Pass and scratched.
Yeah, and you know, that's unfortunate. He was so motivated, so enthusiastic about this year's race, and I heard him speak at pretty close to the Tustamina 200. He had spoken, and he said that his team looked better than ever. But that dang dehydration thing, that comes up, and that really spooks a dog team and the musher themselves. A dog can deteriorate very quickly in a short amount of time if he becomes dehydrated.
Absolutely, and that's particularly a problem with a lot of the dogs who come from kennels and have trained in areas where it's generally a lot colder than it is now. You know, we're looking at temperatures of about 20 to 25 degrees above zero in McGrath, where it's not uncommon for it to be 20 or even 40 below. So it's considerably warmer, at least in the early part of the course, than it usually is.
Exactly. That is exactly right. So I'm sure that quite a few mushers are dealing with that dehydration issue. It is so important that dogs get proper nutrition, proper hydration at those checkpoints. That's why that checkpoint routine is so critical. And these mushers have it down to a science on what they're feeding and what they're hydrating with and when they snack and what they snack with and all that sort of thing. And I hope to have a show, one of these shows in the next few days, have an expert from Inukshuk Dog Food on to talk about proper feeding and hydrating of sled dogs on races such as the Iditarod. And we're going to talk a little bit about Inukshuk here in a little while. But before we do, what do you see shaping up here in day four? Day three right now. We're a day ahead of our broadcast. On the trail, it looks like Aaron Burmeister is in first, Ali Zirkel second, Mitch Stevie, Lance Mackey, Paul Gephardt, and Jake Perkowitz in the top six. What do you see shaping up out there?
Well, for one thing, it is shaping up to be a very, very fast race. Because of the high temperatures, there were some people who were afraid that the course would really deteriorate. I think there was a big push for a lot of mushers to get through the early, more technically challenging part of the race as quickly as possible. And, of course, Martin Boozer, with his I'm going to basically run for almost 24 hours strategy, has turned this race upside down. Now, I think what we're going to see is as teams get to and past McGrath and to places like Tacotna and start taking their 24s, we're going to really see how Martin Boozer's strategy is going to pay off. He took his 24 back in Roan, as did Matt Saylor, and they both are on the move again. This is where the Iditarod gets a little bit tricky, and people who maybe have not followed the race before might not be able to keep track exactly who's in the lead, because although Aaron Burmeister and Ali Zirkel and the pack that they're leading are further down the trail, none of them have taken their 24-hour mandatory rest. And because Martin has taken his 24, he's going to basically have an extra day where he and his team are moving and everybody else is stopped. So we'll see how much distance he can make up, but given that he was able to basically, with minimal stops, make a run all the way from Willow to Roan, it's conceivable that he could leap back out into the front of the pack.
And that's exactly right. And can you tell our listeners, we talk about the 24-hour rest a lot, but there are really three mandatory stops on the Iditarod, and the dogs have to stop for these periods of time. I know we mentioned it, I believe, on the preview show, if not on our day one coverage. What are those mandatory stops that each musher has to make?
They're, the 24-hour stop they can take anywhere along the course. And then there's an 8-hour mandatory stop along the Yukon River, at one of the checkpoints along the Yukon River. And then there is a mandatory 8-hour stop that all mushers must take at White Mountain, which is the second to last checkpoint. It's White Mountain and then Safety, and then they go into Nome. Safety, most people will stop there for a minute or 2 minutes, just long enough to put on their bibs and make the dash into Nome. So the White Mountain stop, I think, was intended to give the dogs a bit of a rest, give the mushers a bit of a rest, and make sure that there weren't any potentially disastrous things that could happen to people at the very end of the race.
And for you mentioned just a minute ago about how difficult it is to follow this race, whether we're doing it on GPS or through Facebook or social media or other ways that us armchair mushers are following the race. It is very difficult to figure out who's in first, who's in second, et cetera, until everybody has taken that 24. Once everybody has taken it, then you can really start to figure out where people are in their standings, because the other two mandatory 8 hours are relatively at the same place for most of the mushers. So next, Alex, can you give us some distances? Most of the mushers right now are in Roan, or have been in Roan as their last checkpoint, and then several of them, it looks like at the moment, 33 of them are in or out of Nikolai. How far is Roan from the start in Willow as well as Nikolai?
Roan is 100 and... Oh, now you're going to make me do math. It's 167 miles from Willow, and then from Roan to Nikolai is an additional 75 miles. It's relatively short from there. It's only 48 miles from Nikolai to McGrath. McGrath is a major hub for the Iditarod, chiefly because there's regular scheduled commercial airline service in and out of Nikolai, in and out of McGrath. So a lot of times if a dog is dropped, it will be, if it's near to McGrath, it will be flown to McGrath before it's flown back to Anchorage. And a lot of the supplies and a lot of the race officials and observers will come in and out of McGrath as well.
And as well as Takotna, which is a little bit further down the trail, often you'll find, especially a lot of the premier mushers, the front of the pack guys, will often take their 24s at either McGrath or a little bit on down the trail in Takotna. Do you have a mileage from Takotna from the start, Alex?
Yeah, Takotna is 18 miles past McGrath, and it's 318 miles from Willow.
So about a third of the, a little bit less than a third of the way then.
Yeah, and then the next checkpoint after that is Ophir, which is only 13 miles past Takotna.
Right. So tonight we're going to showcase our musher as we do every night, but before we do you have any information, and maybe you do, maybe you don't, I don't know, on the plane crash with the folks that were coming up to volunteer. Did you hear about that, Alex?
Yeah, the only thing I heard is that there were three fatalities, and I believe I read that all three were from Eagle River.
Right. The pilot, and I apologize, I don't have their names, but one of them was a 10-year-old little girl. The pilot and two other folks were flying up to, I believe they were flying up to McGrath, but they crashed their plane near Rainy Pass, which is about a 3,200-foot pass. Probably the most, it is the highest place on the Iditarod Trail. They crashed their plane there and unfortunately perished at that point. But our prayers definitely go out to the family and to all of those involved there. It's such a tragic thing when, you know, they're going up there to donate their time and to volunteer for something like the Iditarod and unfortunately lose their lives because of it.
Absolutely, yeah. Before we get into the musher we're going to talk about, I just want to mention briefly, we had spoken about Cindy Abbott yesterday and had an interview with her There was a report last night that she was considering scratching. She apparently, very early in the race, one of her dogs, one of her leaders, wanted to go on a junior Iditarod trail rather than on the Iditarod trail that he was supposed to go on. And there was a little bit of an incident with the sled, and she got turned around and fell off the sled and pulled a muscle, which was very painful for her. So she had told a reporter that she was thinking about possibly scratching, but then she was able to get through the steps last night and through the Dalzell Gorge, and seems to be doing actually fairly well and has not scratched. So of course we wish her the best, and we wish her a very speedy muscle recovery, and hope that she's able to continue. With her, as with all of these mushers, I think almost all the time when a musher makes a decision to scratch, it's because of consideration for the dogs. Either the dogs are not performing well, or they don't feel that they can physically be able to give the support to the dogs that will be necessary out on the trail.
That's exactly right, and I definitely have firsthand experience of that just this year, having to scratch from a race down in the Tustamina 200 because of that. I had to take into account the health of my dogs and the safety of my dogs in order to continue. Of course, I was rearing at the bit, wanting to finish my first qualifier and be on down the trail and get that under my belt, but I sat back for a long time and thought about it, and even spoke to my neighbor and friend and an Iditarod veteran, Vern Halter. He and I spoke a long time about that, and we made the decision that for the best of our dogs that we had to scratch, and it was probably one of the best decisions that I ever made, at least for the safety of our dogs. So we never want to hold it against any musher for scratching. And I know a lot of people, you know, they follow these guys, and you know, they become their fans, and they get a little upset if they scratch, but it's part of mushing. It happens. Things like this occur, and it's almost always, as Alex said, for the safety of the dogs. That's what every one of us mushers are in tune with and care about the most, is the safety of our dogs.
Right, and it's you know, it might not seem like it happens to everyone, but it literally happens to everyone. Lance Mackey had to scratch from the Yukon Quest a little earlier this year. Jeff King had to scratch from the Iditarod recently, last year, I believe. And so this is definitely something that can happen. And obviously everyone wants to continue down the trail, and everyone wants to finish and to succeed and to do well. But I think what casual fans of the race have to keep in mind is that mushers are deeply, deeply committed to the care of their dogs. And I don't think that there is anyone running these races who would put their dogs at risk.
I totally agree with that, Alex. So let's talk about our featured musher. If folks haven't had a chance, head over to our Facebook page at Dog Works Radio and check out the photo that we shared from Inukshuk Dog Food. They are sponsoring Mr. Aaron Peck. He is running this race. He is not a rookie, but he is currently. Do you have his standings there, Alex? Where is he at right now?
Yeah, he's solidly in the middle of the pack. I believe he
36.
Is around, yeah, exactly.
So on our Facebook wall, we have a picture of Aaron Peck as he's leading his team down the steps, probably the most notorious section of the Iditarod Trail, and it's a photo that shows what can happen during one of these runs down the steps. You guys have to check this out. It is a photo you will never forget if you're a mushing fan. But before before you guys head over to check out that picture, we want to talk a little bit about Mr. Aaron Peck. What do you have to say?
Okay, well, Aaron Peck is 33. He's from Grand Prairie, Alberta, Canada. And he divides his year into two parts. In the summers, he is a buffalo farmer, and then during the winter, he trains and races dogs. He said that he got into mushing when he was a kid, and Susan Butcher was winning her 4 out of 5 years in a row, and just was intrigued by the sport and started learning more and more about it. He was mushing his first dog team when he was 13, and he said that the first time he was on a sled, he knew that that's what he wanted to do, because it was an ideal combination of three of the things he loved the most: winter, dogs, and travel. So when he was 19, he came up to Alaska, and he worked as a handler for Martin Boozer, and he described that as dog mushing university, because he got to learn everything there. Handlers take care of the dogs. They scoop poop, they feed the dogs, they take them on some training runs, and in the case of working with someone like Martin Boozer, you get a chance to get their strategies and their philosophy of dog care. And Martin is someone who is legendary about insisting that the dogs get the finest care available. Aaron Peck ran the Iditarod for the first time with Martin's puppy team in the year 2000, and he finished 54th. He ran again in 2005 and finished 43rd. And then in the 2009 race, he had to scratch. And he said that it was the best thing that could have happened to him, because it really refocused him. And for the last 4 years, he's been concentrating more on shorter races in Canada and in the Western U.S. He's run the Wyoming Stage Stop race 4 times. That's a race that goes through Wyoming, Montana, Idaho, and Utah. He finished 2nd in 2012, and he won the race just a few weeks ago in February. Aaron Peck is a guy who is very deeply spiritual, and he dedicates his mushing career to encouraging everyone to use and develop their own God-given skills. And he says that his goal in mushing for himself, and what he tries to impart to everyone he meets, is that you need to understand and strengthen the gifts that you've been given, because that's why you're here.
You know, every one of these, you know, I love hearing your stories, and so many folks do. We get emails and comments all night long after our show is broadcast about how these stories are such an inspiration. And, you know, that's what makes this, as well as many other sports, such a cool thing to follow. Everybody has their own individual stories, their own little slice of the pie, so to speak, their own little place in the world. But everybody has their own little take on it, don't they?
Absolutely. And, you know, a lot of people, we've said a number of times, I don't think I've said it yet this year, but I said it a lot last year, the Iditarod is a bunch of different races that are happening at the same time. There's the front of the pack racers who are really in it to win. There's the middle of the pack people who are trying to improve. And then there are people in the middle and in the back who are mushing for various personal reasons, or to achieve something, or to, you know, spread the word about a disease, or to prove to themselves or to others that they can do this very difficult thing. And one of the things that we try to do in this show is to really illustrate that there is a lot more going on in this race than just the 5 or 6 people that you read about and you hear about all of the time.
And that's exactly right. And that's why we try to showcase all of these different guys and girls, men and women, should I say, that are so involved in this. You know, many of them trained for decades to get to that starting line and hopefully finish that race in Nome. But it is, as Alex said, it's not necessarily if you win or if you come in first or second or 10th or 30th. It's just a finishing that. It's such a monumental goal to overcome for so many people, Mr. Peck included. You know, I'm sure if he does well, whether he's in first or where he's at right now at 36th, he will have accomplished something that he set out to do, which is such a big part of this race.
Yeah, absolutely. And the other thing I just wanted to mention, and I was thinking about this afternoon, one of the things that makes the Iditarod very different from a lot of sporting events is that fans of the race generally, you know, although a lot of fans will have their favorites that they are particularly rooting for, I have never heard anyone who's an Iditarod fan talk about rooting against a musher.
Exactly.
And in most sports, you have, you know, you have your Yankee haters, or you have your Red Sox haters, or you have people who can't stand the New York Knicks, or whatever team it is, the San Francisco Giants. I've never heard an Iditarod person say, "I just hate this musher. I hope he does poorly." And I think there's an appreciation for those of us who follow the sport, and you know, for people like you who are mushers themselves and are hoping to run the race. There's an appreciation of how difficult this is, and an appreciation that everyone who finishes, and pretty much everyone who attempts it, has achieved something remarkable.
I totally agree. I don't think there's anybody out there. You know, I've met a lot of folks over the years, and even the mushers that are in the race themselves, they pay so much respect to everybody else that's involved, including the big names, the Kings, the Mackeys, the Boosters, all of those guys. You know, I've had so many of these guys on our Mushing Radio show, and so many of them will be so forthcoming with their advice. And one thing that I always ask these guys, and Alex, we have about 3.5 minutes left, I don't want to cut us off here. One of the things I always ask these guys on every show is, what is one piece of advice you could tell the up-and-coming musher, the junior mushers, the guy that has a couple of dogs in the backyard? And they're all so willing to give that advice and be so helpful to just about everyone around them.
Yeah, and I know I told this story last year, and I'll try to tell it very quickly. But when I was in Nome in 2010, which was very much at the end of the race, and Lance Mackey had just won his fourth Iditarod in a row, every single musher who came in while I was in Nome, and we're talking the last four or five mushers who finished, Lance Mackey was out there at the finish line even when there were only six or eight people there. Lance was one of them, and he was the first or the second person to congratulate each and every one of those mushers who came across the line.
That's very cool, and I think a lot of those guys do that, whether they're there first or last. They want to see every one of their – it's almost like a brotherhood or a sisterhood or whatever. If you can – they know the drill. They know what it takes to finish this and how difficult it is, whether it's their rookie run or their 30th run or their 29th run or whatever time – however many times they've entered this event. It is – something that they show respect to both their competitors and to the folks that follow them.
Right, absolutely. And as Sue Allen said in Mush the Movie, it doesn't matter if you're a top 10 finisher or if you got the Red Lantern. If you're a finisher, you're part of a very special club.
That's exactly right. So, Alex, a couple of minutes left. What do you want to talk about tomorrow? We're getting into that time where folks are taking their 24s and strategies are being made. You'll often hear that the race really starts at about Roan. So we're there. Most of the folks are in and out of there, or at least getting ready to this evening. What's going to happen in the next day or so?
Well, in the next day or so, we're going to see a lot of people start taking their 24s, and I think we can really focus a little bit more about what the emerging strategies are for the various teams. And we've seen, you know, people like Dallas Seavey and John Baker, who have been very solidly in the middle of the pack and are going to start making their move if they have a move that they can make this year.
There you go. Alex, we're about out of time. I'll talk to you tomorrow, okay?
Okay.
Have a good day. Robert Forto, on behalf of our co-host Alex Stein, we'll see you guys next time. Goodbye.
Community radio is what you make it. If you want to be involved with Radio Free Palmer, contact us on the web, radiofreepalmer.org. We're looking for ideas, we're looking for volunteers, and we're looking for help. Thank you so much, and enjoy.